It's unusual, to say the least, when a first novel walks away with a National Book Award for fiction. But it is not unprecedented. At least, not anymore. Julia Glass pulled off this spectacular literary coup with her debut novel. It's called Three Junes. Steve Paulson wondered why, closing in on middle age, Julia Glass decided to write a book.
It was something I had to do because I had recently been through a time in my own life when I'd had a complete spin out. I'd had several heartbreaking things happen to me, and I was in that kind of limbo where you watch the world going on about you and you wonder if you're ever really going to live your life fully again.
Can you tell me some about what happened to you in this particularly dark period?
You know, I have to say, I'm a Yankee by upbringing, and normally I wouldn't tend toward revealing a lot about my private life. But the fact is, you know, when you meet your readers and you talk about your book, I like to be open about where my stories come from. And what happened to me was that at age 35, 36, I went through a sad divorce. And within a year, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And then less than 2 weeks later, my only sibling, my sister, who I love very much, killed herself.
Wow, and that's a lot to go through.
You know, it is. And I will say that when that much bad stuff happens to you, my reaction actually wasn't the why me reaction. You know, it was like, okay, so it's me. But when so many bad things happen, there's a part of you that finds it all very humorous. I mean, I have to say that there was always this black comic voice in my head, you know, because here I was. My diagnosis preceded, of course, major surgery, treatment for cancer. So that during that period, when I was going through major surgery and treatment, I was helping my parents deal with my sister's loss, helping myself, help her friends. And I can remember this one day when I had to actually photocopy suicide notes that she had left. And I had just gotten out of surgery, and I had this drain coming out of my armpit, you know, to be graphic about it. And I'm trying to sort of work this new Xerox machine at the copy shop, and the drain is getting in the way. And I'm thinking, you know, this is the most ludicrous moment. I mean, talk about lows. And I mean, I can laugh now. This was 10 years ago, I have to say. And it's easier now for me to talk about it. I still miss my sister very, very much. And it's an eternal question. A friend of mine has said that when someone close to you commits suicide, it becomes a question in your life that will never be answered. Because no matter how many times you examine it and re-examine it, there are always angles and what ifs. So, I guess I was going to describe this other day, this moment that is sort of emblematic to me of that period of my life, which was, well, when she died, she was living in Florida, and my parents and I all went down together to deal with her things and her affairs, and she was cremated, and my mother did not want to deal with her ashes, so I asked that her ashes be mailed to me. I didn't want them to be, or be shipped to me, because she was going to be cremated after we left. And I went back to New York, and one of the things I had to do was get a second opinion on my pathology. So I had to go up to this hospital, and it was snowing that day, and they couldn't find my slides. And I had gotten this notice that there was a package at the post office for me, and I thought I knew exactly what this package was. And I was determined it would not stay overnight in the post office. So I finally got my pathology slides, you know, the actual slides that are slices of my tumor packaged up. I rushed downtown in the rush hour subway. I ran from the subway stop, just got to the post office, got the package, and it was indeed in it. You know, it's like this shoebox-sized cardboard box. And I knew, you know, it was from the funeral home. And I walked home from there, and it was snowing, and I couldn't carry an umbrella because I had this package under one arm, which had my pathology slides, and a package under the other arm, which was my sister's ashes. And I remember thinking, you know, I thought of James Joyce's, you know, eternal story, The Dead, and the snow settling on everything, and the notion of death everywhere. And I thought, you know, I am holding death under both of my arms, you know, my potential death. Mm-hmm. The extent of my cancer wasn't even known at that point, and the death of my only sibling under my other arm. And it just, you know, it was this very searing moment in my consciousness. And it's one I would never use in fiction, I think, because nobody would ever believe it.
What do you see as the role of fiction in dealing with tragedy?
I can only talk about that in, I suppose, a fairly narcissistic fashion to begin with. In other words, how am I, you know, not what am I giving to readers, but how is it helping me? Or what does it mean in my life? And part of this story was my trying in a parallel narrative to answer these questions. You know, how do we go on? And I think that I also wanted to write a story about heartbreak that had a happy or hopeful ending. And that was a way of my kind of prescribing a happy ending for myself. It's almost as if, though I'm not very religious, you know, saying to God here, you know, give to me what I am giving to these characters. And, you know, hopefully, God, you read literary fiction, because not many guys do. But
well, I know there are some therapists who advocate, you know, even if you don't feel something, the best way to get through a really difficult time is to kind of imagine that you're doing this. And, you know, hopefully then things will follow and you will sort of, your life will become the thing that you have imagined, sort of like modeling, you know,
visualizing, I think. Yeah. I mean, and I have to say that's something that especially, you know, that's a lot of people use that approach with cancer and I couldn't buy it. You know, I just couldn't do it without laughing. Mm-hmm. So yes, in a certain way, that's true. And I was going to say something also about now that I am meeting readers who have read the book and hearing their responses, it's funny that I should be so surprised that for many people, this book has been very consoling. The first time I had this experience was right before the book was published. My publisher sent me to the BEA, which is the big booksellers convention that's held every spring. And they gave away 250 copies of my books to booksellers. And actually, it was probably my moment of greatest celebrity other than the National Book Awards because, you know, I didn't even think that when I made my main character a bookseller that I was going to make myself incredibly popular with all these. And I've been accused of doing this on purpose to sort of game the debut of my book. So I had this huge line of booksellers and this one woman came through the line with the book and I signed it for her. And she said, you know, I have not read your book, but a friend of mine who's a bookseller in, I don't know, it was Kansas or somewhere who was not at the convention, he called me up and he said, you have to read this book. You know, it's so moving. He said, when I finished this book, I went straight to the phone and I called my father and I told him that I loved him. Hmm. And, you know, I'm actually kind of crying thinking about that moment because that's the power of fiction. And I know that power from reading fiction, but the thought that I could do that for someone else was kind of mind-blowing, and it still is.
Hmm. Now, the success of this book, Three Junes, is remarkable. I mean, it's your first novel. It came out when you were, what, in your mid-40s?
46.
46. From what I've read, you didn't have a book contract when you were writing this. I mean,
no,
obviously,
I didn't.
It's highly risky, I mean, to be spending all of that time.
It's
with,
like, I mean, daydreaming.
I mean, who knows if it's going to be successful at all. And, you know, not only do you get it published, you win the National Book Award, even though there wasn't actually that much media attention about this when the book first came out.
There wasn't. And in a way, I'm kind of grateful that I didn't have one of those very splashy instant debuts that some novels did last year. I mean, yes, I'd love to have sold as many copies as The Lovely Bones, but that can turn against your book in a way. I had nice reviews, but not a lot, actually. And I know my publisher was disappointed that I didn't get chosen for, like, the Barnes & Noble Discover Great Voices or whatever that series is. And so I was, you know, shunned a little bit in some corners, but I got good reviews where it counted, but not big, prominent reviews. And then I did, of course, you know, sort of buried underneath the National Book Award is the fact that my book was chosen for one of the TV book clubs for the, you know, Good Morning America, actually by a wonderful book group in Milwaukee, and saw, I mean, the book just gradually built. And the joke at my publisher was that they called it the Energizer Bunny. But I'll tell you, when it was nominated for the National Book Award, we were all extremely surprised.
They must have been in shock then when it won.
Completely. And I think my whole table had a heart attack. I mean, you know, the National Book Award evening is, it's a lot like the Academy Awards, except that, of course, it's not broadcast on network television and you don't have a fashion designer volunteer to take you under their wing and make you look beautiful for the evening. So you arrive and it's an evening with you know, 1,000 people sitting down to dinner, if you can imagine that, and then a balcony full of press people. And here's Steve Martin, who's the host, very witty. But you do not know who wins until the chair of the committee for your category gets up on the stage, describes the finalists with the jackets projected on the wall, and says the winner. And each publisher has to pay, you know, I don't know, $12,000 or something. Don't quote me on that. To buy a table. And of course, if you have a book that's nominated, you're not going to not buy a table. But I know they thought, we're here as spectators. We're very proud of Julie. And it's a moment I'll never forget.
Now, I read somewhere that in your acceptance speech, after you won the National Book Award, you said, well, this is to all of those late bloomers out there.
I did at the end, you know, because even a good friend of mine who was in publishing, she said, you know, you are a little long in the tooth to be making a debut. And I was suddenly seized with fear that, you know, they'd meet me and go, oh, we won't get enough mileage out of her. You know, how many books do you think she's got left in her, the old gray mare? But, you know, recently there have been a lot of late debuts. And it's great to see that because I have a lot of company out there. But it's also wonderful to be an inspiration. And I realized as I stood up there, you know, this was, you know, how unlikely was this? And I just thought, I hope other people look at this and say, you know, maybe it isn't too late. Sometimes it is, but maybe it really isn't.
Julia Glass calls her novel Three Junes. She won the 2002 National Book Award for Fiction. Steve Paulson spoke with her.